Welcome to the Family Alpha Podcast, a place where men, families, and the truth have a voice. The information shared on this podcast is meant to be applied. Now, here's your host, Zach Small, founder of thefamilyalpha.com and co-founder of thefraternityofexcellence.com. Let's get to work.
Today, I am joined by Dean Abbott. Dean Abbott and I have been going back and forth for years now. He writes at deanabbott.com. He's a husband, a father, a coach, a former college professor, an author, and just all around man's man. He's inside the Fraternity of Excellence. We've had many back and forths. And what really turned me on to him was when he started writing about the quiet life and how you can simplify your life in this modern age that's just constant traffic and a barrage of things and updates inside your mind. So it helped me quiet my life down, which helped me be more productive. And recently, Dean published another book on character and community, and we're going to dive into that today. So stay tuned and check out these knowledge bombs he's going to be dropping. Dean, welcome to the show.
Thank you for having me on here, Zach.
I really appreciate you making the time to come on because you are a busy man with many things happening. But you recently published on character and community. How has the response been? You know, what inspired you to write this book?
Well, you know, it's interesting. The book is the book came about from a lot of small short pieces that I wrote originally for the blog, and I wrote them not ever planning them to be a book. I thought I just wanted to explore some foundational ideas with regard to really character and culture. And so I started to write more and more of these, and eventually I thought, well, I bet I could put these together in a little book and publish them. And when I did that, I noticed they came to, you know, 70 pages or so. And I thought, well, why not just make it an even 100? Because I'm a little bit OCD about numbers. I could never publish a book that was 77 pages long because I'm thinking, that's just another 23 pages. I'm a little OCD about numbers. So I thought, well, I'll just bump it up to an even 100. And that way there'll be about 25% of the material in there would be completely new and exclusive to the book and would be a kind of an exclusive value to people in that way. And so that's how the book came about, is that I started out writing short pieces, exploring these themes. And then when I realized that they were having an impact, I thought, well, why not package them and make them available in a different way? And so that just happened this week or last week, and it's live and available now on Amazon.
So I'll have the link to that and all the rest of your content below. The thing that stuck out to me as I was reading it, you know, I've read Ego is the Enemy and The Obstacle is the Way by Ryan Holiday, and this had a very similar vibe to it. And not from the stoic angle, but honestly, just learning to control what you can, you know, let the other things be what they are while you look to develop yourself as an individual. And I think that is one of the greatest messages. And why I'm really glad I could get you on, you know, that people need to hear nowadays. You know, they need to see like, hey, you are an individual. You do have control over your life, but you're spending so much mental energy and time worrying about the things that you can't control and thinking about the things that are out of your control. So when you were going through, I guess the direct question, do you find yourself reading works like that of the Stoic philosophers, a lot of men like that? Because it seems like that's a solid foundation you built upon.
Right. You know, I would say yes, that I've been very much influenced by Stoicism. Even this summer, I finished the Meditations of Marcus Aurelius. Marcus Aurelius was a Roman emperor, and he's one of the major figures in the history of Stoicism. And many of his ideas are very much sort of consonant with what I'm saying and the way that I approach things. One of the books that most people don't think of as a work in Stoicism, but I think actually resonates very heavily with that philosophy and that very much influenced me, is Stephen Covey's The Seven Habits of Highly Effective People. I read that book when I was a confused 20, 21-year-old, And at the time, it was like a window opening for me, like suddenly understanding things. But over the years, 30 years that I've been living with that book, more and more deeply, I understand what he's saying. And all of that really, I think, really is a sort of stoicism and definitely plays into the perspective that I'm putting forward in these essays. So yes, the answer is yes.
It's interesting how you talk about how that book opened up your mind to things. You know, reading this book, I almost feel spoiled to kind of have this one-on-one interaction before, you know, the world recognizes how, you know, the quality and the insights you can take from it, and you get pretty busy on all these other podcasts. So as I'm reading through this, and for everybody listening, you know, I highly recommend you dive in. You know, it's weird in a positive way, the way you say things and the doors it opens in your mind that weren't there before. You know, I feel like I'm a very read man, a well-read man. I'm a learned man. You know, I have my graduate degree. I've gone through the technical texts. I've gone through personal reading. And still, going through this book, it's like, wow, why had I never thought of this like that? You know, it's the angle you say things is, it's unique, in especially in the community we're in. So I really appreciate it. And we're going to dive into a few aspects of it. And I mean, why not get started now? Unless you have anything else you want to add?
Yeah, I want to say, you know, part of what I try to do when I'm writing about these kinds of topics is to say things as simply as possible. And I think that is something that people appreciate. And it's sort of what you're kind of saying. It's like, oh, well, I never thought of it that way. And part of the reason is that some of these concepts get talked about in a way that is less focused. People talk about them in a way that's true. What I'm trying to do is always boil it down to a single sentence that I can say, boom, here it is. And I think that when I do that, it kind of brings people up short, and they recognize the truth that I'm trying to put forward, but very rarely do they encounter it put as bluntly and as simply. And so that's, I really try to emphasize simplicity in this, because all of the things that I'm writing about, when you boil them down, are in fact very simple. They're just not easy. And most people, I think, have easy and simple confused, right? It's just like working out, right? You want to build muscle? Okay, go lift a bunch of heavy stuff. Simple, right? Very difficult, but also very simple. And I think part of what I want to help people do is to get clarity on the distinction between what's easy and what's simple. Because I think most people prefer complicated and easy to simple and hard.
You see, that in itself is one of those nuggets I'm talking about. that was it live, you know, like, all right, like, I get it. Maybe I'm convoluting a few things more than I need to, because it's a complex topic being discussed, but it doesn't need to be discussed with significant complexity.
You know? Right. And so I think, you know, when you begin exploring these topics, they do boil down to very simple ideas that can be expressed in a single sentence. But if they are true, then their implications are almost infinite and can be applied in numerous situations with numerous and almost infinite levels of nuance. But really, there's a principle there that can be sort of bluntly stated.
I mean, I think that segues into my opening question for you, the opening salvo of this discussion, in that you start the book, and I always wonder why authors start things the way they do. So I'd like to know that, as well as, you know, when you began the book, the first thing is happiness is not just a feeling. And you start talking about happiness and how it's also not your natural state. Why did you start with happiness? Do you think that's the beginning of things, you know, with people? They're always trying to be happy, or is that something personal to you?
I think that, I think people do have an inborn desire to be happy. And so let me talk a little bit about what I mean by that. First, what I don't mean is having fun, right? I don't mean that you go through life and you never have a down moment, and life is just a continual party. What I mean by happiness is something more like a state of maturity, a state of flourishing. So I see the human person as really born with lots of potential, like a seed, right? And when I say the word happiness, what I don't mean is temporary distractions that make you have a good feeling. I mean that full state of maturity. So you go from the acorn to the oak tree. And so the acorn is the potential that people have. And instead of, for human beings, instead of being a great big oak tree, what you grow toward is happiness, a state of complete maturity and fulfillment. And so that's an older conception of happiness, I think, than a lot of our modern conceptions, which is, I went to a birthday party and it was a lot of fun, and now it's over and now I'm not happy anymore. This kind of constantly fluctuating mood. And what I'm talking about is not a mood at all. And so that's kind of what I mean by it's not just a feeling, because it's rather an ongoing state that we are trying to reach by moving toward the fulfillment of what we ought to be. And when I say it's not natural, what I mean is that, well, you know, you take an acorn and you just, I don't know, put it in your house on a shelf, or drop it in a glass of water, or whatever, that acorn is not going to reach its full state of potential maturity. It doesn't just happen unless there are certain conditions met that allow it to move toward this full state of mature flourishing. And for the human being is obviously different from an oak tree, because the human being, unlike all other creatures, has consciousness and can direct and make choices that contribute to or detract from the process of reaching that state of fulfillment. And so it's not just natural that if you just make no effort, you will just somehow be happy, or that if you are relieved of all obligation, all social obligations, all, you know, if everybody would just leave you alone, it is not the case that you would just be this little ball of joy and sunshine. And that people have argued that in the history of thought, right? That what really makes people unhappy is their social obligations. And I don't think that's true. That instead, we have to make choices and guide our own development toward that state that I'm calling happiness. And that there are certain kinds of choices that we know from long history of practice that lead us toward that state, and we know what leads us away from that state. So in the book, I make the point, you know, if you have kids, I have kids, we've all been children. Nobody ever taught you how to be selfish and whiny and manipulative and demanding. You just came into the world knowing how to do that. Right? That's just the natural way people are. I want my toy, and I'm just going to scream until you give it to me. We all did that when we were at a certain age. What we have to be taught is we have to be taught how to live in the world and to mature and be happy through exercising our conscious ability to control and maintain ourselves. And that's, you see that with children, that's part of the process of their maturing, but it's also part of the long-term maturing of the human being toward that ultimate state of maturity or and flourishing. And that practice of choosing to move toward that state of flourishing is what I'm calling character. It's that process by which we consciously guide our own maturing process.
You know, something that stood out while you were saying all that is something I've touched on frequently, which is a lack of a rite of passage in a lot of mm-hmm. children's lives to becoming an adult. And I think that would play a role in that. You know, I think there are a lot of adults right now who they confuse excited with happy. You know, going to the birthday party, that's exciting, but that doesn't mean you're happy. You know, right. Whereas the state of being with happiness, you can be content, happiness or content, you know, with your life, even when things aren't going your way. You know, you had a bad day at work, but you're still a happy, living a good life, even though it was a net negative possibly for whatever occurred, you right. know, and also it's the lack of distractions that are needed to have a happy life, not the additional of, you know, looking away from where you're at. Walking alone in the woods shouldn't give you anxiety. Right. You know, being alone in your head, thinking of, you know, your life is this problem and that problem. And I think a lot of people, they don't develop that. So when you take away their phone or you take away the TV, they're like, well, what do I do? They're more anxious being alone with themselves without distraction than if there were 100 things going on, where in our modern age, that's like the default setting for people. They're only happy when distracted, but that happiness is obviously in quotations. They're not actually happy. They're excited and distracted.
Yeah, that gets into some of the material we talk about when we talk about the quieter life too. But basically, you know, in our culture, we don't necessarily have anymore a clear idea of what an adult is. We don't, and there are lots of reasons for that. And one of them, of course, is that it's very profitable for people to continue to be adolescents as long as possible, right? Because if you are the kind of person who doesn't have much of a identity or self-definition that arises from your own inward set of values and convictions, well, then it's easier to sell you the newest thing, whatever that is, whether that's, you know, whatever the new fad is. You're more profitable consumer if you don't have, if you're not distracted by that stuff because you're focused on achieving some mission that you're driven by inwardly. And so, you know, you mentioned there's no rite of passage. Well, that's largely true. And one reason for that is because there's no passage. There's no real passage for many, many people from adolescence into adulthood. And so there's no right to market.
You followed happiness in the book. You follow happiness up with self-pity. And as you're saying this, you know, with it being profitable, it seems like there's this perpetual cycle of self-pity. You know, you don't have the newest phone. You don't have the greatest body. You don't have the newest clothes. You don't have the newest TV show. You don't know the newest trend. And in chasing that newest thing, you develop that sense of self-pity. You're always feeling bad about yourself. You're always looking down on yourself compared to others. So how do you go from the addressing happiness to self-pity? What brought that on? Or do you just like the juxtaposition of being the guy who you can't be put in a box and you just like to, hey, happy, self-pity?
Well, no, they are connected in that the movement toward the state of maturity and flourishing that I'm calling happiness only happens as people exercise their capacity for consciously directing their own growth. And the only way to do that is to own yourself in the most fundamental way. And what that means is taking responsibility for who you are and for your circumstances. Stephen Covey talks about being proactive. And by that, he means something a little more than just taking responsibility. But that's a huge part of it. That is the foundation. That's the first step. Because nothing else can happen unless you are willing to say, my life is my life. I am responsible for my thoughts, for my feelings, for my actions, for my words, and I'm responsible for my circumstances. Now, obviously, sometimes people are in circumstances they're not responsible for. You know, if you're walking along the street and someone kidnaps you and takes you away from your home and you're the victim of a crime, okay, you're not responsible for those circumstances. But what you have to distinguish between is actual victimhood and a victim mindset. I think Jocko Willink talks about extreme ownership. And it's all the same concept where you are not going, you're not a person who focuses on how other people are controlling you, but rather you own and take responsibility for yourself and for your circumstances to as great a degree as possible. And you try to root out of yourself that natural, what I think is a pretty natural tendency to blame others for things that are happening to you that you don't like. And that tendency to blame others for things that are happening to you that you don't like, one of the most common manifestations of that is self-pity, right? So it's a, you know, I say it's a constant danger because it's you have problems, you have things in your life you don't like, and so you feel bad about that, and you think, well, this is worse for me than it is for other people, and it's most people sort of normally and naturally take this view of reality where they are the center, and everything bad that happens is even worse if it happens to them. And so to begin moving, I think, toward that, toward happiness requires telling yourself, I'm not going to do that anymore. My life is what it is largely because of the choices that I have made. And people don't normally embrace that quickly because they feel hurt. And so clarifying the line between places where you really have been a victim and having a victim mindset is, I think, critical. So if you are a person who, you were a little kid and someone in your family was really mean to you, they mistreated you, et cetera, absolutely, that's victimhood, right? You were really hurt by someone. But what you can't do is allow that experience of victimization, which we've all been through, to become the root of your identity. And part of the problem with having been a victim in some way is that it is disempowering to you. And you're a victim because there's a power mismatch. The problem with maintaining a victim mindset is that you continually give that power away. And it's only by accepting responsibility for your larger set of circumstances that you can reclaim the power that's necessary to fuel you toward maturity and happiness. And so that's the connection between self-pity and happiness, is that self-pity is, I think, probably the first major roadblock toward moving in that direction. And it's an anti-character feature of our thinking, because we don't tend to say, when we're feeling sorry for ourselves, we don't tend to say, how do I choose the good thing here? How do I make the right choice, regardless of what other people are doing to me? And only once we get beyond that kind of thinking can we really start to empower ourselves to create a better future.
You know, as incredible insights. As you're going through that, I'm thinking of how you made part one of the book is on character, and part two is a community. But in this part one, where we're still talking about the character, you know, it seems like maturity continues to come up, that mm-hmm. word continues to come up. And I can't help but think of how the immature mind is in that place where they're talking about the problems and the perceived victimhood, and they're constantly focused on the problem. But once you start to make that shift towards maturity, you're looking at solutions. You start looking at how can I fix the problem instead of, hey, I'm facing this problem. And where you're talking about Stephen Covey and being proactive, being the foundation, that sort of leads to the next section where you, to me at least, the foundation of going from immature to mature is becoming decisive. And in the book, you talk about not only setting direction, but having confidence in yourself to go towards the direction that you've set. So how do you see, is there a way to bridge that gap for someone who's like, I do want better, but maybe they don't really have a direction, or they don't have the confidence to follow through on where they do want to go?
Well, yeah, there's several things I want to say about that. But before we get deeply into decisiveness and choosing, I want to talk for a minute about another author, another book that's been very influential on me, just because when people hear these things, it's good for them to have resources to be able to pursue things beyond this podcast. But I've also been very influenced by Viktor Frankl. And Viktor Frankl was a psychiatrist who was a Jew living in, I believe he was living in Austria during World War II, and he was eventually taken and placed in one of the concentration camps. And his most famous book is short, and it's an easy read, and his most famous book is called Man's Search for Meaning. And in that, he's a paradigmatic case for rejecting the victim mindset. So, I mean, if we're going to look at anybody in the world and say that person is justified in having a victim mindset, well, it seems to me it would be the guy in the Nazi concentration camp that we would all say, okay.
I don't think you'll find any counter to that.
Right. And so part of the power of Frankl's approach is that he was in, you know, one of the worst kinds of situations imaginable, where he came fully to realize that no matter what his captors and torturers did to him, they could not take from him his power to choose, especially his power to choose his own attitude and his power to decide how he would respond to the things that happened to him. And so I highly recommend that book for people who are, you know, struggling with this, because I know that saying to people, look, you have to come to a point where you say, I am responsible for everything about my life, that can be a hard pill to swallow for people, especially people who've really been through a lot of very difficult experiences. And so I just want to encourage people to not give up on that and to explore that idea a little more. You know, in terms of decisiveness, well, in the book, the essay is a little bit aimed toward people who are drifting, right? People who don't live decisively and kind of spend a lot of their life in, an ambiguous state where they don't know what they should do and they don't know who they are. So I want to back that up a little bit and see if I can talk about it in terms of making choices for developing your character. After you have taken, you've come to a point where you're willing to take responsibility for yourself and for all that means, I think the next step, and I don't know that I have an essay addressing this in this little book. Maybe I need to create one. The next step is that you have to have some kind of mission or vision for your life. And both Frankl and Stephen Covey talk about this extensively. But if you don't have a mission or vision for your life, you really ultimately have no basis on which to make any decision. And you see this everywhere you go. So we have lots and lots of people in America, especially, who have no vision for being physically healthy, right? Like, that's just not really on their radar. And so they're driving around. I'm one of these people. I have no vision for my physical health, no real commitment to that. I'm driving around. Maybe I'm not even hungry. I just drive by McDonald's, and they've got a picture of a Big Mac, and that looks pretty good. I have extra money. I think I'll just pop in there and get one. So you, without a clear vision or mission for what you're trying to do, you're just blown by the wind. Just like you just see some stimulus and you just react. You're just saying, oh, look at that picture of a pretty Big Mac. I'll have one of those. And pretty soon you've eaten a couple, and that has its consequences. And so to become more decisive and to consciously move toward realizing some kind of vision or mission in your life, you have to do a lot of reflecting. And all of that comes out of the inside, right? So human beings, going back to the acorn analogy, are born with potential that if the conditions are right, can move toward a fulfilled state of maturity. And that process is in one sense universal, and in another it's unique. And so everyone wants to become the oak tree, but for human beings, what that looks like is going to change a little bit from person to person. So I have a unique mission that when I think, what is it that deep inside of me needs to happen? That might involve all sorts of things, right? Maybe my deepest, for one person, the path to maturity, it involves music, okay? For one, it involves trying to relieve suffering through medicine. For one, it involves knowing that I need to have a bunch of books out there that I've written. It could be any of those things. And no one can know his or her sort of unique version of what it would mean to move toward maturity without a lot of inner reflection. And for some people, that process is more difficult. Some people, because of their experiences, might be kind of cut off and really need to work to unearth that. And some people, it's just on the surface. But only once you have that can you become decisive. Because only once you have that underlying vision or mission and clarity about that can you know when life presents you options, which it does every moment of every day. Only if you have a guiding set of principles, a guiding vision, can you distinguish between which one of these options is the right one to move you toward your unique maturity. And so you have to know which way you're supposed to go in order to make choices that lead you toward flourishing. And that's not an easy process necessarily at the beginning for lots of people. And that's why it's kind of scary, right? Because you can stay in your comfort zone a lot more if you don't make decisions. There's something very comforting about being a leaf blown by the wind, because somebody else is in charge, and at least for a while, you can just kind of kick back and ride the breeze. Well, ultimately, of course, that's unfulfilling because it doesn't lead to that full state of maturity. And so beginning to take the helm and drive yourself toward an end that you have visualized can be risky and scary. And so it requires a process of developing trust in yourself. And of course, the only way to develop trust in yourself is to make a bunch of decisions and to experience their consequences, especially positive ones. And so I think we're kind of talking about what is happiness. Happiness is that unique state of fulfillment. Number two, what's the role of self-pity? I'm saying self-pity is an expression of the victim mindset that blocks you moving down that path toward maturity. And then step three, what we're talking about now is really once you have rejected that victim mindset, beginning this process of making conscious decisions about what kind of person you want to be, what kind of reality you want to create around yourself, and learning to trust yourself to do that. So those are the connections, 1, 2, 3.
You know, it's interesting. As you're going through, I've received countless messages from men and women saying they don't know what they want to do with their life. Mm. And a lot of that is, I think they're looking at others and using that person's compass as their personal, you know, sense of direction in life as to what happiness and success is. And for each person, it's as unique as their fingerprint. You know, like what works for Dean won't work for Zach, you know, and that's just not how things, you're an individual. You've got to experience your life. And one of the things I always say is like, you need to go out and do what you want to go out and do. And like you said, make a decision, experience the consequences. What made you, what did you enjoy? Well, what didn't you like? And they think, well, I've got to, you know, for us that are on social media, I've got to find a way to make money for my social media. Or they see someone like you pumping out books. I've got to produce books and that will make me happy. But then a week later, they see somebody else, you know, create a clothing brand. All right, I need to go out and make a bunch of t-shirts and that will make, and they're always from thing to thing to thing. And in the quiet life, you know, I like how you bring old school wisdom to the modern day. And in the book, you sort of do it again. So right after this, you start talking about working with your hands and going out and experiencing things, physical things. And we're living in a time where the only way for you to experience physical discomfort for a large majority of the developed world is intentional action. You literally have to go out of your way to feel any sort of discomfort. And or before we recorded, I was telling you, I'm sitting in a shed that's air conditioned. And if I wanted to, I could go into my house that's air conditioned. And then if I want to go somewhere, go into my vehicle that's climate controlled and drive to a store that's climate controlled, drive back, go home, not do anything, eat, fall asleep in one day. At no point am I feeling any discomfort. At no point am I working and building calluses or working muscles at all. If I chose to simply be the leaf, as you said, and just get along, you know, to get along, I could do that very easily. But that's going to blow you to wherever the world wants you to go, not where you want to go. So could you touch on why you included the need to work with your hands and maybe the spiritual element that comes with that?
Yeah, before I do that, I want to talk a little bit about what do you do, what should you do with your life, right? That question, because that's obviously, that's something I struggled with a lot when I was younger too. And here's the answer I wish someone had given me, is to say, well, stop thinking about what you want to do with your life and think about what you'd like to do with the next 30 minutes. Okay. And if you could do anything, what would you like to do with the next 30 minutes? And your answer to that is going to be a clue to what you should do with your life, right? So if you had 30 free minutes and had the power to do anything, well, you should do, if you're going to do something that you feel like promotes your growth, that feels good to you, that is something that pushes you down that path toward maturity, well, you can identify that in the next 30 minutes. Well, just do that thing every 30 minutes for the rest of your life or something like that, right? That your life is too long a time for you to know what to do with it. So rather than looking outward and trying to plan your life, look at what it is that makes you come alive, what makes you flourish. So, and you're giving yourself clues to this all the time. Here's one that people might not think of. All right, you're going to sit down. It's the end of the day. You're going to sit down. You're going to turn and you're going to watch something on Netflix. anybody who's ever turned on Netflix knows that you could easily spend the whole time you're scheduled to watch a movie, you could easily spend it looking for something to watch, right? Because you have a million choices. Well, out of that million choices, there's going to be something that you gravitate toward. And you gravitate toward that thing because there's something in you that's drawn to it for a reason. And if you think to yourself, well, what is it about this thing that drew me toward it versus all the other things that I could have watched? Well, that is going to be a revelation to you about yourself. And so the question of what do you do with your life? Well, you follow the path that you are cluing yourself into through all of the choices that you make, right? So if I have my choice to watch something, whatever I want on Netflix, it's probably going to be some kind of a gentle historical drama set in England, right? That's me. Okay, so why do I like that? Well, I like stories where that are quiet, right? Where emphasis on relationships, where we get to see people making choices to build their character. Huh? Maybe I should write a book about that. You see? And so one thing leads to another if you are aware of yourself and what moves you. So that's how you discover, I think, that larger sense of mission and vision I was talking about a few minutes ago. So I wanted to put that out there as a way for people, because I know the question is going to be, well, how do I discover what my mission or vision is? Well, you do it by paying attention to yourself. And in terms of working with your hands, I think what I've meant by that is to just say, you know, we live in a world now where you can work all day and not have produced anything tangible. I'm sure there are people whose job it is to input numbers into a computer system, and they might do that all day. Well, and I'm not saying that you know, you shouldn't have that job or whatever, but ultimately, I think moving toward fulfillment requires people to have a sense that they are competent to create real changes, concrete realities in the world, independently from the larger structures like their job or whatever. And to some degree, even be able to provide for something for themselves, provide something for others. And only, I think, when we work with our hands, and I don't mean necessarily that everyone has to be a carpenter, right? The carpenter is the sort of archetypal case of working with your hands. It's the guy out in this wood shop, and he's building a dress or a chest of drawers or whatever. And that's awesome if that's what you want to do. But I'm talking about working with your hands in a little bit more of a metaphorical way. It's simply taking the responsibility, again, to produce tangible realities that are meaningful to you and to other people. And as we have moved more and more toward a virtual and information-based economy, we've just culturally tended to lose that kind of connection, even though I think our souls really long a lot of the time to see, look, I have built this thing, and to live your life building nothing tangible is, I think, almost always going to end you up in a place that's unfulfilling.
It reminds me of a tweet I recently read, and I was trying to bring it up, and I found it. And it really does highlight the point of not being busy for the sake of being busy, but actually giving yourself something productive and constructive, you know, to do. And the tweet, it comes from one of our FOE brothers, the Blue Gorilla, John Parker. And it says, "I don't understand it. No matter how much I drink coffee, how much I play on my phone, or how much I refresh my email or look up things online or go to the kitchen for snacks or message my friends or scroll on Twitter and play with the cats, I still can't get any writing done." And it's like, these people, you did a lot of things, but you achieved nothing. You have to have, and this goes back to direction, you know, staying busy and scrolling on social media and looking and laughing and liking and sharing, that didn't build anything for you or your endeavor. You know, for us, you know, as writers, as authors, you can spend a lot of time researching. You can spend a lot of time writing tweets or writing blog posts. But if you don't sit down and commit to writing the three chapters or writing, you know, whatever segment of the book you want to write, if you can't commit yourself to doing that, which might be harder, that's deep work. You know, a lot of the other stuff is surface level. If you don't commit to the deep work, you'll never achieve the deep meaning and the deep satisfaction. You'll only have superficial surface level happiness, as opposed to the stuff that goes right to your heart and soul, which is the deep work. You know, with working with your hands, you know, when you said, think of something you do for 30 minutes, I thought of playing with my kids. You know, recently they figured out how to throw a frisbee. So we've been having a lot of, like, that's what I would do for 30 minutes. I'd go outside, I would play, but that's it's outside. It's with my hands, literally, you know, but also the figurative, I'm helping them grow. I'm spending time and giving presents to my children. So that's the proverbial, I guess, you know, hands in their upbringing, their life. So these are elements that you need to keep in mind, that we're not saying fill your schedule to the max with things.
Right.
No, have a central thing. What is it that you would go, like the Netflix analogy? What is the one thing you gravitate towards? Start building something of that nature.
Right. And I think that's the connection with the other things we've talked about. So, you know, we were just talking about having a vision and mission. And so when I write about work with your hands, whatever you do, I think the ultimate point is that once you kind of have some sense of vision or mission, you have to translate that into real world work. And that, again, I think that's culturally discouraged just by the structure of most people's work life. I'm printing out these papers and I'm moving them to this physical file. A lot of people do that at work. And that's a different thing from actually using your hands, by which I guess I mean all of the gifts and resources that you have available to you, to bring into physical reality something that was not there before, that's meaningful to you.
Now that covers us on the character side. So we're going to shift a little bit to part two of the book, which is community. And I could not be more impressed, proud, or just straight up, you know, in awe of the fact that you tackled this issue, which I think plagues the entire world right now. And that is of loneliness. I have been beating this drum, and I'm really glad you decided, you threw it on the first part of community. I was like, man, this guy, like, you're putting yourself in the chopping block there, because a lot of people think, well, we're more connected than ever, and technology has been the greatest improvement. And my argument has always been, well, look at how isolated people are. There's an illusion of connection, but there is no true connections happening. Inside FOE, you know, the Fraternity of Excellence, we constantly stress your real world needs to be better than your online world. And going out and meeting the men inside our group, that's the focus. It's great for us to have our Zooms and our video chats, but the real connection, the way you consummate a friendship with a man is you shake his hand in the real world. So I wanted this, could you touch on your direct, you know, confrontation or targeting of the fact that we're in the modern era, people are lonely, and in the future, they're only going to get lonelier.
Yeah, I think in our contemporary culture, right, we have lots and lots of cultural forces that tend to separate us. We exist culturally as individuals, and our bonds to other people are slowly dissolved by all sorts of things. The kids who move 1,000 miles from their parents to go to college, right? Well, that might be valuable. It might not. But one way or another, is that it does weaken the bond. And so it's almost like we live in a bucket of solvent where we can make bonds with one another, but floating in the air is this stuff that just that tends to dissolve those. And I think, just like we were talking a few minutes ago about the person who floats on the leaf, the person who's like the leaf who floats on the wind, most people simply accept those conditions which dissolve their bonds with one another without question. And so they don't make any special effort to maintain those bonds. And so we end up with people who live with a kind of background of loneliness. It's like a background noise of loneliness that most people don't even identify as loneliness because it's so normal for them. And so relationships become fungible, you know, replaceable. I have some friends here. Well, I here in, I don't know, Kentucky where I live, if I move to California, I'll just have new friends. And so you end up missing out on the kind of special bond that grows only over long periods of time. And you know, these are my people, I belong here, this is my place. And people just become unrooted in our time. And so loneliness becomes the sort of warp and woof of their lives.
I mean, would you agree that that's also one of the leading points on people not really having a direction? Is they're like, oh, well, nobody cares and nothing matters. And I think they're just apathetic to everything. So when you can say, well, nobody cares whether I'm alive or dead. Nobody cares if I succeed or fail. Like, it doesn't matter. If you had connections, if you weren't so lonely and you actually put yourself out there to make connections and to make actual friends who care about your existence, you know, maybe then you'd have a little bit more fuel in the tank to want to achieve things or maybe maintain a standard. You know, I don't want to let you down. I don't want to let any of the men in our group down. So sometimes when it comes to making the right or wrong choice, it's simply, hey, I don't want to let the guys down. Like, that's what pushes me to do the right thing and to start creating and wanting to make something of myself. And the people who've isolated themselves to oblivion, that's the biggest thing right there, is you're so lonely that why, you know, I can understand why you'd be like, oh, whatever, I'm just going to do my job and die. Well,
yeah,
you know, there's not much else going on really.
Right. So here's what I would say. I would say we live in a society in which solitude is rare and isolation is common. Okay. Solitude being time you spend alone that's profitable for growth and self-knowledge. Isolation being when you desire to have connection and can't get it. So I think, you know, you're asking, do people not have a vision for their lives because they don't have connection? Well, I think there's actually an important vicious cycle to point out there. So people feel disconnected. And I think a lot of people feel disconnected very early on in life because maybe there's family problems or they have trouble connecting socially at school or wherever it is. So that by the time people are emerging into young adulthood, many people already feel very disconnected. Now, again, to solve that problem is going to require accepting responsibility. And so a lot of people use that sense of disconnection to reinforce a kind of victim mindset. Nobody cares about me. And that might be true. I don't know. But they believe it's true. Nobody cares about me. Why should I do anything for myself, right? Why should I try to build anything good when nobody notices me, nobody's connected to me or whatever? And so then you get into a vicious cycle. The person is saying, I won't do the work I need to do to make things better because I'm not connected to anybody. Well, guess what? the great way to stay disconnected from everybody is to refuse to do the work you're supposed to do. And I say vicious cycle, but it's not like a wheel that just keeps turning. It's like a spiral that keeps going down. And because no one can control the behavior of other people, you can't compel people to be connected to you. You can't compel them to care about you. You can only take responsibility for yourself and say, look, I'm dealing with this loneliness. I have to solve that problem and move from there.
In the text, you know, we spoke about the immature mind talking about problems and the mature mind talking about solutions. And so you, of course, follow this up with solutions, but it almost seems counterintuitive. So I agree with you. You know, a lot of people, they are the source of all of their problems. But with that comes power, because they're also the solution. You made every decision to get you to where you are. You know, accepting that burden of responsibility can weigh heavy, depending on how far down you are and what decisions you've made. But also, when you look at your hands and look inside yourself, you can fix this. You are, in fact, the only one who can fix this through making better decisions or choosing to live differently. And in that, when people decide that they're going to become their solution, you say that there are going to be three conflicts they should expect. The first is that they're going to get lonely. The second is that they're going to feel like they don't know what they're doing. And the third, that they're going to fear being judged. So it's interesting that the first one is when you feel isolated or lonely and you start to fix yourself, that's the first thing you're going to face. It's like, oh, I'm on my island of one. But anybody who's ever lost weight, got themselves in shape, are focused on building a business, you know, they've been met immediately by the crab in the bucket mentality, or the fact that people want you to do well, but never better than themselves. So once you start losing weight, oh, you're losing too much weight. Oh, you're becoming superficial. You're focused too much on muscles. Once you start to change your life for the better, oh, you know, I've recently gone sober. I'm 16 days free from alcohol. And people are like, oh, you just need, thank you. You just need to, you don't need to eliminate it. You just need to learn how to control it. And I'm like, why are we saying these things? So you start to feel that. You're like, is it me? Am I alone? Am I the weird one? But in all reality, that's exactly what you're saying. You're going to be met with that. You have to continue forward. So could you touch on those three, you know, obstacles that people need to get over, such as, you know, feeling lonely, like you don't know what you're doing, or people are going to start judging you?
Yeah. So I want to make a distinction between two kinds of loneliness. One is that sense of total disconnection, right? I don't have any relationships. I don't have, let's call that first kind of loneliness, alienation, right? Because you're alienated from other people. You can't make the connections. You can't create synergistic, profitable connections with other people. And you don't know your own, you don't have a vision or mission for yourself. And so you're alienated from your own self, right? And that alienation is very painful. But there's another kind of loneliness that might come up too, and that is when you begin, like you said, trying to live out your mission. You're making choices. You're trying to develop your character. You're moving toward your unique maturity. Well, most people don't do that, and so you're going to stand out, and you're, as you're moving down the path to becoming the person you have the potential to be, you're going to just have fewer and fewer people who are also moving alongside you. And so it's going to be lonely in that sense. The consolation is that you are no longer alienated. And so you might be lonely because you have had to leave some people behind, because you have less in common with people who are still that leaf blowing on the wind. But you are no longer alienated from your own sense of uniqueness and your own sense of mission. And the people you do encounter are actually people that you can connect with and create more synergy, right? You create synergy. You connect with these people and you can create more than you could alone. And so there will be some loneliness, but it is not the same kind of loneliness where you are alienated and disempowered. It's just a loneliness where you know that you have taken a step forward that has required you to leave people behind who don't want to take that same step. The thing about the imposter syndrome or feeling like you don't know what you're doing, of course, this is sort of part of choosing to live your life in a way that you are always pushing at the edge of your comfort zone in some way. Now, not every moment of every day of your life needs to be you pushing some boundary, but as a rule, that's where growth happens, right? I mean, think about the tree. You've seen a tree that's broken or cut, and it has rings. Well, those rings they're always pushing outward. The new ring is on the outside of the older ring. And so growth is always kind of happening at the margins. And if you're going to be a person who's self-consciously pursuing your own growth toward maturity, you're always going to be at that margin of your comfort zone. Sometime. You're going to have to spend some time there. And that means you're always going to feel like you don't know what you're doing, right? I don't know if you mentioned I'm working on another book right now. And every day I sit down at the computer and I'm just typing. And I'm thinking, I don't know what I'm talking about. You know, I'm making this up off the top of my head as I'm going along. And of course, you kind of have that imposter syndrome feeling. Well, who am I to say this? And it's not until, okay, I'm going to go, I know it's a rough draft. I'm going to go back. I'm going to fix it. I'm going to polish it. And in the end, it will be something that I can be proud of. But when I'm doing that writing, I'm at that edge of my abilities. And so I do always have a little bit of that feeling of I don't really know what I'm doing. But that's how you grow, right? And especially in terms of, finally, the thing about you're going to fear being judged, well, you're making yourself, by owning your circumstances, owning your power, and moving forward, you are making yourself an unusual person, right? It's like you've always been surrounded by people who blow on the wind like a leaf, and you've always been a leaf, and then all of a sudden you think, you know, actually, I think I'm going to just grow some legs and walk. And all of the other leaves are going to say, look at him. He's crazy. He thinks he's going to grow legs and walk. And of course, like you were saying, many people want you to do well, but not better than they are doing. And that's just going to come up. And that's going to be a sign, going back to the beginning, the problem we were talking about at the beginning in terms of loneliness, that's going to be a sign that you're going to basically eventually have to move on from those kinds of people if you want to continue down your path. Because unless those leaves are going to grow legs and walk with you, then you're going to eventually have to get some distance from those people. And the sign that you're going to have to do that is that they continually judge you for owning your life and moving in the direction that's good for you.
At first, I struggled with that, you know, coming out and sharing, you know, as Zach Small instead of Hunter Drew, you know, what are people going to say when like they see I'm talking about masculinity, fatherhood, marriage, you know, leadership, all these things, what kind of pushback am I going to get? And there certainly was some, but I immediately learned it's good to be hated or judged by the wrong people. By the right people. You want the right people to stand against you because you do have to draw a line, and not everybody's going to like you, and that's okay. And everything you've done got you to where you are. And if you want to go somewhere different or you want to go to greater heights, you've got to do different things. You've got to take different actions, like the leaf growing the legs. You got to stop being blown around by the wind if you want to stop living a life that's blown around by the wind. If you want more and you want to set down roots, you got to get up on your feet. You got to walk, you know, and become a tree instead of just a leaf. So I completely agree with all of that. And I think that plays well into, you know, the, you follow these three conflicts up with starting to think like a producer. And, you know, I've seen you go from like your personal growth. And we were talking before we started recording of how now you see opportunity everywhere. And it really does highlight that success begets success. So once you get up and start walking and doing that one right action, it's like you knock down the dominoes of success. And that little domino is going to knock down a bigger one. So now that you're walking, you get to experience greater happiness. Now that you're experiencing greater happiness, you start seeing greater opportunities to connect with higher quality people. And people, listeners may not like the fact that I'm saying higher quality, but let's not kid ourselves. There are some people that will propel you forward to make more money, have better relationships, you know, become a better person. And there are people who will hold you back. So some friends are better than other friends. They'll make you have a better life. They'll bring you to greater heights. Other friends want you to stay with them and keep doing the thing because your improvement or your success is a mirror and it holds it up to their lifestyle. Maybe they're living a more mediocre. Maybe they're capable of more, but they're not ready to face that yet. You know, and you changing kind of accelerates their either going left and like, yeah, I'm going to start improving, or going doubling down. Like, no, this is where I want to be, until they hit rock bottom. They've got to build from there. You don't know how you're going to impact others, and all you can control, back to, you know, the Stoic philosophy, is you can control you, your thoughts, your feelings, your actions. So don't worry about them, but do understand that once you can break free from those chains of, you know, sticking with the group and staying with the herd, you now start thinking like a producer. You now start seeing opportunity where before you saw, you know, failure or, you know, dead ends. So how is that for you now that you're seeing, you know, and like I said, we were talking about this earlier, there's just opportunities everywhere. Like what is that like? It seems liberating, you know, at least in my life, but I love hearing from others their success when they flip that switch.
Yeah, it's, well, it's, you know, it's exciting. It's a little bit overwhelming too. Especially because you always have commitments to projects, or you have obligations that somewhat interfere with your ability to take advantage of the opportunities that are created for you. You know, in the book, I talk about the importance of moving from a consumer mindset. And the consumer mindset is actually related to the victim mindset, in that they both share a kind of passive quality. I'm just going to sit here and I'm going to consume. And my focus is on how can I consume the next thing to keep me happy or keep me at some state that I want to be in, versus a producer mindset, which is how can I make the next thing? How can I create the next valuable experience? How can I do something that will contribute to others and they will value? You know, and so we were talking about the book I'm working on currently. Well, you know, writing a book is a very long-term process. It's taken me several months to get to this point. And so part of that process is beginning to learn to discriminate against between what are opportunities and what are the best opportunities, right? And so trying to, of all the things I could do, sort through which are the ones that are most going to push me forward the furthest, the fastest. And to capitalize on those while I let the others go away from me, and let other people for whom those are better, maybe better fits or whatever, work with those. And I'm just sticking to those things that are most conducive to getting me where I'm trying to go.
I think that's something any creator, or as you say, producer, can relate to, is there are like a freaking thousand things that I'm like, I want to do this, I want to do that, I want to write about this and record that. And I'm like, man, I just need to do like one thing. Let's focus on that. And then, you know, kind of, this is why I love whiteboards. That way the ideas can come out of my head and I can just see them like, all right, I can do this, then this. You start to prioritize them, you know, and I never want to be the person who's like, oh, I have 1,000 things I could do. So therefore I do zero.
Right. Right. Yes. You know, it's the important thing is to be done. When it comes to projects, done is the ultimate quality that you're going for. Not perfect, and certainly not imagined. Like, oh, I can imagine all these things I could do, and I'm happy with the mental creation, as opposed to actually for making yourself do the work to make that mental creation a physical one.
You know, it's funny when you have like all these possibilities to go. When you're a person who's living abundantly and with the producer mindset, everything is a good thing. You know, like no matter what, any problem you see, you start to think of, oh, how could I solve that? It's never that's a dead end. And you also start to create, you know, better relationships with people because people want to be around somebody who's uplifting. People want to be around a person who's in a good mood and is constantly trying to find ways to like, hey, you're never forcing yourself on them. You're like, hey, have you ever, you're really good at speaking. Have you ever tried this? You know, have you ever thought about recording a speech or something for whatever, or writing ideas down? You know, you're always looking to help just create growth in others. And one of the calls to action I constantly have is how, even if you're not comfortable, you know, writing on a blog or anything like that, or writing a book, you know, just living and embodying good values and morals and living like a producer will inspire others. You kind of light that fire. It's almost like you give them permission to be happy. Because we're in such a place where everybody's trying to maintain such an even keel that I'm so anti that. I mean, even the way I speak, I can hear it now. Like I always like project more. Like I'm like, yeah, I want the world to hear me. And when I'm out with our friends and family, I want the world to hear them. I want them to find their voice and, you know, to come up. So it's one of those things where just by living your life on like a producer, you sort of give others permission to do the same, where otherwise they may not think they could have.
One of the things that's been surprising to me is just how much impact my talking about these ideas have on people. I suppose that before I started publicly writing about these things, whether that's been in a book or on a blog or even on Twitter, I didn't quite grasp how desperate and confused and in how much pain many people live. And one of the things you see as you start moving in this direction is you see how little sometimes it takes to make a really positive difference for somebody. You know, a tweet. It can make a positive difference for people. And it's easy when you don't quite grasp the level of desperation that people experience to imagine that, oh, I couldn't do anything to help people. And to underestimate how effective you can be merely by exercising your gifts in a way that promotes growth.
You know, it was the quiet life that hit me in the stomach like a sledgehammer. I mean, here I am, I'm doing these things, I'm achieving these things. And I read that and there was like a connection to the words that just blew me away. I think I straight DM was like, dude, that's it. Like that right there is, you are on the money. Like that is such a great message that the world needs right now. And that sort of plays into the next, you know, section of the book I wanted to talk about, which is the stories and the relationships that we have. And you shared a story about Rainbow Sparkle, which I never thought those words I would say together on a podcast, Sparkle. But Rainbow Sparkle, you know, it's like the hero of the story. And it reminded me that, you know, for others, they could have read that blog and all right, cool. I like this, moving on. But for me in that time and the place in my life, reading that, a relationship was formed there between us and the words that you shared. Had you not shared them, I wouldn't have had that moment. Had I not had that insight in that moment, who knows where I end up? I'm here. I'm happy. Would I be here and happy had I not, you know, figured out how to live a quiet life and bring peace to my life instead of trying to keep up with the many projects? I couldn't tell you, but I can tell you what happened, where I'm at, and how I improved from it. And you sharing the story of Rainbow Sparkle, which I'm wondering if you could touch on now, you know, really it highlighted that it doesn't have to make sense. If there's a story, emotion will overcome logic.
Mm-hmm. Well, okay. So several years ago, our family was at the zoo, and our youngest daughter, she was very young. She's going to turn 10 this week. So she was probably, she was still in a stroller. So let's say she was 2 or 3. I don't know. She was very young. And we were walking to some particular part of the zoo, and she tripped, and she landed and hit her head on the pavement. And of course, she's a little kid, so she starts screaming, and I pick her up, and she seems okay. But somehow, for some reason, the zoo had a medic, and he looked at her, and he said, "Well, I think she's okay. She hit her head, but I think she's okay. Just keep an eye on her to make sure there are no signs of concussion." I said, "Like what?" It's like, he said, "Well, like if she started to fall asleep immediately or she couldn't stay awake or whatever." I said, "Okay." So I put her back in the stroller, take about 2 steps, look down, she's asleep. So now we're concerned. So we call the medic guy back, and by the time he gets there, she's starting to wake up a little bit, but we all jump on this golf cart and go zipping through the zoo back to the office where the ambulance meets us to take her to the hospital to be checked out. And we all ride in the ambulances. And I was riding in the front of an ambulance with the driver. My wife and 2 daughters were in the second ambulance in the back. And to comfort our daughter, one of the paramedics reached under the seat and pulled out a stuffed bear and gave it to our daughter, who had been hurt. And she named that bear Rainbow Sparkle, and Rainbow Sparkle has been with her faithfully everywhere she goes through the years. And in the book, I write a little story about how Rainbow Sparkle disappeared for a couple of weeks, and it was kind of a big deal until finally we found Rainbow Sparkle stuffed into a bench in the basement where she had been while someone was playing My Little Pony or something and forgotten about. And so part of the point there is that, you know, we are really shaped by experiences and the stories that we tell about them. And we don't simply make ourselves out of nothing, but rather we are these beings who are formed by these experiences and the stories we tell about them and the meanings that grow out of those experiences. So to put that in context of the other things we've been talking about, we are constantly in this intersection where we have experiences. Meaning comes out of those experiences. We are formed by attachments and stories that we make. And at the same time, we are constantly charged with using our own power and consciousness to make decisions about how we will respond to those things. And so there's an interplay between the narratives and the experiences that create those narratives and the story that I decide to tell about myself and in the world. And it's in the intersection where those things come together that we constantly have to decide how I'm going to use this experience. How will I make meaning out of this experience in a way that promotes growth, right? So that's one of the things I'm trying to get at in telling that story.
So one of the things that it highlighted for me is you always hear of like, hey, do you want to get together? All right, what do you want to do? And for so many, it's just you sit in the backyard and you drink some beer and you talk. Like very rarely do friends go out on adventures any longer. Like very rarely are men meeting up and going and doing something that creates a story, creates a memory. Mm-hmm. You know, at the last fraternity meetup, we a bunch of dudes met in Florida and we got flooded out and it was just wild. And none of the men that were there will ever forget that. It was crazy. And it created the bond that nothing else would. And I think this goes back to being lonely in the modern era. Is you, sure, you sent a couple of DMs or you shared some tweets, but that's usually where it ends. Or maybe some Facebook messages, depending on the platform. You know, right now, you and I are face-to-face. We're having a discussion. That's the next element. We're creating a deeper bond. If you and I were sitting at a coffee place or at your house or my house at the table, we had a microphone and we're having this conversation, it'd be even closer bond. You know, it would create a deeper story. And I think people don't have, and not even I think, I know, people don't have enough stories with those in their life. So they don't have, like, replace Rainbow Sparkle with a friend's name, you know, Steve, Kyle, John, whatever. You know, you haven't done anything with them, and therefore there's no real connection there outside of your barbecue or whatever it is you guys do. You know, but what if you guys actually had you hiked a mountain and you had a significant conversation on life on that hike up that mountain? Well, you and that person would forever have a story that connected you deeper, and therefore you would care more about them, they would care more about you, and thus, going back to my original point, when it comes to you making better decisions in your life, you're going to think of that person. You don't want to let those people down who you have stories with. And therefore, your fuel for greater growth is sometimes simply not wanting to let those people down that you have stories with. Mm-hmm. But if you never go out and do things, if you never put yourself into the world, if you remain isolated yet connected, you know, you're not getting the full, you're not optimizing your life. You're not getting the full experience of human connection, which is to go do things and create memories with those. I call it hanging a Polaroid. It's like your life, you know, your lifeline is a string. And you don't know when it's going to end. So your goal is to put up as many Polaroids hanging from it, which are memories. And when you die, you just see all the Polaroids before you go. And it's my opinion that your aim should be to have as many of those hanging up. That's why instead of sitting down with my kids and watching TV, we'll go to the park constantly, or we'll go play baseball, we'll go throw a frisbee, or whatever the case may be. It's not, hey, here's a tablet for you, and I'm going to watch TV. There's no story being made there. There's no connection being made there. So I think that's the story of Rainbow Sparkle is something that people need to step back and recognize. It's not about the bear. Right. There's a lot more to that story than just the bear.
You know, you're saying that about the hanging, the Polaroids, et cetera. A lot of that too goes back to the fact that in our culture, our whole culture is designed to allow people to just be passive consumers. Right. And so when you are when the default state is I'm a leaf blown by the wind, I just do whatever I have to do so I can get home and watch Netflix again. Well, sure, you're not going to pursue experiences in the company of others. Here's one thing that along those lines that always sort of baffles me is there are many, many people in the world, and certainly in modern America, who have the financial resources to travel and who never go anywhere. And I'm not saying everyone needs to, you know, take a trip to Mongolia or whatever, but there are literally people who, even though there's no external roadblock, almost never leave their town. I've known people who've never been out of the state where they live. And it's kind of related to what you're saying, right? It's like, well, we're not seeking self-consciously to put ourselves in positions where we're going to have any kind of experience that's going to make us into a better person, or or deepen the relationship between me and someone else.
Well, I think that also highlights the point that you can't truly understand life if you're not experiencing anything outside your small bubble. Mm-hmm. You know, being able to, if you've, like, I'm from Rhode Island, so it's 5 minutes, I'm outside my state, so I don't fall into that category. But you know, in the Navy, going to France, Greece, Italy, Dubai, seeing these different cultures, seeing what true poverty looks like, seeing what true rich, you know, affluence looks like, you know, seeing that whole spectrum, I now have a greater appreciation for my life situation. I've seen people, I will never forget getting off the ship, taking a taxi to some town, And when we got out, there were a bunch of gypsies. And these little kids came up to us and they tried like picking our pockets. Like we just, you know, go away. And I watched a mother beat like a five-year-old, like start just laying on him because he didn't come back with any coins. So she, and I'm like, that poor kid, like, and you see it and it's just true poverty and true suffering. And it's, some people are so far removed from that, that they think because it's raining out, it's a bad day. Or they're so angry because, you know, somebody was out of like cantaloupe at the grocery store and that ruined their day. That's such a hard life. You know, you didn't get your melons that you wanted to get at the store because they're out of stock or it's not in season. You know, these things, I'm like, this is not suffering. You are so far removed from true suffering that you don't even know what pain feels like. You know, so it's interesting to see people that they don't know what they don't know, but they're so focused on their little bubble that they will never leave it for a variety of reasons. And I think that, you know, highlights the being ostracized, being judged. And to the final point I wanted to touch on in the book is where you said, you know, you aren't crazy for wanting a different life. You know, people are going to think you're crazy for wanting to leave the bubble. They think you're crazy, you know, for wanting to go outside the cave. You know, you've seen all the shadows in the wall, right? You know, I don't remember what, you know, scientist that was or whoever it was, but there we go. So the cave is on the wall, or the shadows in the wall in the cave. You know, you can't leave the cave. There's this out there. There's that out there. You know, you're crazy. I believe you're crazy for wanting to stay. I think you're crazy for not, I think you should err on the side of action and going out and experiencing things because it's experience, you know, not theory, not books read. It's going out and doing the thing that is going to impact you in life. So could you touch on the craziness of wanting a different life and how you aren't insane? You're actually smart.
I think people need to be given some permission to trust themselves. And that if the example that always comes to my mind is the commute, okay? The commute is almost like a universal symbol in our culture of, at least in my mind, of modern life and the unhappinesses that it contains. So you've got an hour-long drive every day to work, and it's, you know, it is a lot of traffic and it's stressful, and you do this twice a day, you spend 2 hours in the car. It is perfectly reasonable to not want to do that, and that's just one example. It's perfectly reasonable for people to not want to work in jobs that are unrewarding. But I think that the default manner of living for most people in our culture is so normal and so taken to be normal that inside many people feel a little bit of, or maybe a lot of shame, or and wonder, well, what's wrong with me that I, you know, that I have this nice car, I have a job, even if I have to drive an hour from it, an hour to it every day. I've got a Costco membership. I've got a big TV. I've got all, what's wrong with me that I'm still not happy? Well, what's wrong is that you aren't moving toward your unique maturity. You're not moving toward growing into the oak tree. You're not, you're caught up in these external realities, but you're not moving toward your sort of happiness and that ultimate larger sense we talked about at the beginning. And I want people to have permission to admit that and to know that if they are feeling that way, that does not make them crazy. In fact, it might be an indicator of sanity that you are at least having the right reaction to a rather unwieldy and unhealthy system that you're in, right? And so don't feel like there's something wrong with you if you are really having a lot of inward sense that something's just not right with the way that your life is set up.
That is an incredibly powerful message that I think many, many need to hear, especially those who are sitting on the commute, you know, possibly right now listening in. You know, something isn't right and you've checked all the boxes you were told would make you happy, but never the ones you made. You didn't make those boxes. Right. You were told what success looks like. You know, we're looking for genuine joy and a genuine appreciation for the life you have and not, I guess, trying to check the boxes to get the approval of others as to what a happy or successful life looks like. Dean, I want to thank you for coming on. I want to thank you for breaking down these topics of on character and community. Like I said, for those listening, the links to all of Dean's content is below. Dean, if somebody wants to work with you or maybe ask you questions, follow up to this discussion, where can they find you?
Well, my blog has been on hiatus for a while. I haven't posted there in a while. But people still have a number of options. I'm on Twitter basically every day. If you have, anybody who has a Twitter account can find me there. My DMs are open, as they say, so you can send me a message there. You can email me to dean@deanabbott.com. Those are probably the two easiest ways to get to me. And I'm happy to talk to anyone and see what we can work out together to help people move toward that unique kind of maturity that we've been talking about.
Absolutely. Dean, thank you for your time. Thank you for coming on. For those who tuned in, thank you for listening.
Thanks for listening. You can join our private men's only community at thefraternityofexcellence.com. And don't forget to find Zach on Twitter and Instagram with the handle @ZachSmall_.